From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, America's first man in space, Alan Shepard. His first flight was in 1961 and lasted only 15 minutes. When he landed on the moon 10 years later, he wasn't the first American there, but he was the first man to hit a golf ball on the moon. Shepard has written a new book about America's race to the moon. Also today, a new romantic comedy. This one's Girl Meets Girl. We talk with filmmakers Rose Trochet and Guinevere Turner about their new movie, Go Fish. And Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir by Henry Louis Gates, Colored People. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton is urging the world to remember World War II veterans and honor a whole generation of heroes. Mr. Clinton gave a speech today at Utah Beach, one of the sites in Normandy where the Allies stormed ashore to begin retaking Europe from Hitler.
We must carry on the work of those who did not return and those who did. We must turn the pain of loss into the power of redemption, so that 50 or 100 or 1,000 years from now, those who bought our liberty with their lives will never be forgotten.
The president then went on to other D-Day ceremonies at Omaha Beach, where he was joined by Britain's Queen Elizabeth, French President François Mitterrand, and tens of thousands of other veterans. Former CBS newsman Walter Cronkite was master of ceremonies.
For each of us here, the memories return. We look to each of the veterans who has returned and say, again, thanks. We look to the white markers which round us out there and say, thanks. Thanks that we stand here today in peace and in friendship on beaches once littered with death and filled with the terror of dying.
Cronkite covered the Normandy invasion as a war correspondent for United Press. The International Atomic Energy Agency is talking about ways to get North Korea to cooperate with weapons inspection. The North has repeatedly refused to let investigators carry out an entire inspection of its nuclear facilities. Observers fear North Korea is secretly developing nuclear weapons. The North insists its nuclear program is peaceful. The head of the IAEA has already reported the North has removed fuel rods from a nuclear reactor. That's made it impossible to tell if any material has been diverted for weapons production. The agency can't do much more to pressure the North. Contract talks between American Airlines and its flight attendants resumed today. It's been more than half a year since President Clinton intervened to stop last Thanksgiving's strike. Bill Zeeble of member station KERA reports from Dallas.
American Airlines, the nation's largest air carrier, suffered far more financial damage than expected following a flight attendant strike last Thanksgiving. After 5 days of the walkout, both sides agreed to binding arbitration, and the attendants went back to work. But the third of three arbitrators wasn't agreed on until last week. As talks continue today, unresolved issues involve health and retirement benefits and monthly work schedules. American Airlines CEO Robert Crandall said the company needs to increase production and cut costs and promises job security in exchange for more cooperation. Flight attendants, though, aren't sure they can agree on a formula all sides are happy with. In that event, talks head for arbitration. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 2 points at 3,770. This is NPR. Chinese authorities say no one survived the crash of a China Airlines jet today. There were 160 people on board the aircraft. The accident was near Xi'an in northern China. Emergency rescue workers say 9 bodies have been pulled from the wreckage. Aviation authorities say the airplane went down minutes after leaving Xi'an. The Chinese official news agency says 9 foreigners were among the passengers. Their nationalities are not known. This is China's worst reported plane crash. The Supreme Court has ruled that a criminal defendant may have his prison sentence increased based on a previous misdemeanor conviction. The ruling says this can happen even if the defendant didn't have a lawyer to help him in the earlier case. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In 1983, Kenneth Nichols pleaded no contest to driving under the influence and was fined $250. He had no lawyer at the time. 7 years later, Nichols pleaded guilty to cocaine possession, and a federal judge, using the federal sentencing guidelines, used the drunk driving misdemeanor conviction to increase the penalty on the drug charges. Nichols was sentenced to 2 years more than he would have been otherwise. He appealed, citing a U.S. Supreme Court decision that held a misdemeanor conviction without benefit of a lawyer could not be used to increase a prison sentence. Today, however, the Supreme Court reversed its earlier ruling by a 6-3 vote. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
A poll released by the New York Daily News finds that New York Governor Mario Cuomo faces a strong challenge for a fourth term in office. His opponent is little-known Republican George Pataki. The Daily News found that if the election were held today, 48% of the poll respondents would vote for Cuomo, while 41% would choose Pataki. The study found that of Pataki's voters, a huge majority said they were voting against Cuomo rather than selecting Pataki. Another 49% said they disapprove of Cuomo's performance. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Shepard, was the first American in space. In 1961, he rode the space capsule Mercury 7 to an altitude of 115 miles. 10 years later, Shepard commanded the Apollo 14 on a mission to the moon. He set up a nuclear-powered science station on the moon and gathered soil and rock samples. In between those two space flights, Shepard was grounded for medical reasons, but he helped direct the space program as chief of NASA's astronaut office. He was an essential part of the team that helped America first get to the moon 25 years ago. Shepard has co-authored a new book about America's race to the moon called Moonshot. I asked him about his first space flight back in 1961. The trip was so brief, he didn't have much time to experiment with weightlessness.
My flight was only 16 minutes. We did have about 5.5 minutes of weightlessness. And the thing which we tried to cram into that 5.5 minutes had to do primarily with my ability to actually control the spacecraft, actually fly it like an airplane. Because we knew that so much of the early days of space depended upon the abilities of a pilot, not only under primary conditions with no casualties, no failures, but also to practice for situations where the pilot would have to take over in order to bring it back in safely. So most of the 5.5 minutes were devoted to my actually controlling the spacecraft and reporting how I was doing and that sort of thing.
How were you doing?
I did great, of course.
I mean, how did it feel to control the spacecraft while being weightless?
Well, it was a tremendous exhilaration, of course, at being up there in the first place. Also, the second place, the fact that everything was going well. And then, lastly, the fact that I flew it exactly as I was supposed to fly it.
Was it what you most wanted, to be that first American in space?
Oh, I think all of us wanted that. We were a very highly competitive group to start with. We were all test pilots. We knew that only one of the seven was going to get to go first. And, everybody wanted to go.
Now, after you became the first American in space, you got something called Meniere's syndrome. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Actually, I had been assigned to command the first Gemini mission, which was the first two-man mission, and Tom Stafford was going to be my co-pilot. We were probably 3 or 4 months into a training cycle when I developed Meniere's syndrome, which has something to do with elevated fluid pressure in the inner ear, which causes dizziness, imbalance, and nausea in some cases. And when we discovered it was more than just a temporary virus, then NASA, of course, grounded me immediately and said, you can stick around if you want. There is maybe 20% chance that you might recover from this thing normally. And if you want to stick around and stay in training, we'll be happy to have you do that. We'll give you a job helping Slayton run the astronaut training program.
It must have been devastating for you.
Very disappointing. Not only the initial reaction to it, to the onset of it, the realization that I wasn't going to fly again right away, and then continuing to watch the rest of the guys go down to the Cape and have all these great flights, and and pat them on the head before they went, and you know, and pat them on the fanny when they came back. It wasn't all that much fun. There was a lot of frustration involved.
You were the chief of the astronaut office, which meant that you, among other things, had to choose which men went on the flights. What would you look for in an astronaut's personality and temperament before deciding to schedule them for a flight?
Well, what we did for the most part was to choose the ones who, the individuals who we thought would make the best commander of the flight, and then ask them which of the available astronauts they would like to fly with. So we got an idea that we got two folks, or three folks in the case of Apollo, at least friendly with each other. We made a couple of mistakes, but for the most part, things went along pretty well.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alan Shepard, and he's written a new book called Moonshot, The Inside Story of America's Race to the Moon. During a launch pad test of Apollo 1, there was a fire and three astronauts were killed, Gus Grissom, Edward White, and Roger Chaffee. What happened?
Well, I think, let me generalize first, and I think what the situation was at that time was that we had flown successful Mercury missions, we had flown successful Gemini missions. There was a sense of pride and accomplishment, but there was also perhaps a little false sense of security, maybe a little bit too much pride, maybe a little bit overconfidence, if you will. And desire, obviously, to get on with the moon landing to try to meet President Kennedy's schedule. And we talk about this in the book, pointing out the fact that Grissom, who was designated to be the commander of that flight, was not at all pleased with some of the things he found in the manufacturing and the testing processes. And even though he protested rather strenuously, somehow the things that needed to be fixed didn't get fixed in time. And, of course, it is a tragedy, in fact, that Gus was killed in the fire along with Ed White and Roger Chaffee. But on the other hand, at this stage in the game, although obviously it's traumatic to lose your buddies, all of a sudden, the NASA people and the aerospace contractor people said, "Hey, you know, this thing really wasn't put together as well as it could have been. Maybe we were in too much of a hurry. There was some redesign. There was a hiatus. Trying to find out exactly what had happened, and with this redesign, with this reassessment, we created a spacecraft that was obviously so much better than the Apollo 1 spacecraft had been. Again, it was really as a result of that fire that all of a sudden the organization said, yeah, folks, we really aren't doing as well as we could have been. And again, that resulted in a really fine program all in all.
You write in your book that you felt you couldn't get too emotional about it and that you had to take the attitude, well, it's part of the business. Did you have to take that attitude for the benefit of the other men who were waiting to be launched?
I think that all of us in those days, basically being test pilots, felt that that was the way things go in our business. I mean, it wasn't the first of our friends that had been killed. A lot of contemporaries over the years of test flying had been lost, killed for one reason or another. So it wasn't the first time that it happened within our fraternity of test pilots. And as I say, it was emotional, but it's one of those things, well, you've got to find out what happened, correct it, and let's get on with the job, folks.
Alan Shepard is my guest, and he writes about being the first man in space and his walk on the moon and many other things as well in a new book that he co-authored called Moonshot. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. back with Alan Shepard, co-author of the new book, Moonshot. You were grounded for several years because of an inner ear problem, and then you were able to be cured through a surgical process that surprised everybody by working and working very well. So then you got to go to the moon, which you'd long wanted to do. But when you took that flight, the Apollo 14, in 1971, February of 1971, you felt that you carried the whole future of the space program with you. Why did your mission have such symbolic import?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story, actually. As soon as I was ungrounded and NASA said, okay, we think you're ready to go, Slayton and I immediately picked a crew and gave me command of Apollo 13. We sent the list to Washington. They said, oh, we can't do that. We said, now, wait a minute, you know, Shepard has been training along with everybody. He's just as bright and just as ready to go as the rest of them. How come? And they said, well, it's just too soon. You give us a political problem. Shepard is so well known, and he's been obviously grounded for so many years, and politically it's just not right. So let's make a deal. Give us another crew for Apollo 13, and we'll let Shepard have 14. So, as you may recall, Apollo 13 took off with Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert. They're halfway on the way to the moon, and they had an explosion which blew out the side of the service module, the mothership. It took away all their primary power system. And there they were on the way to the moon without the power to do it. Obviously, they weren't going to be able to land. They used the lunar module power systems to communicate, to help navigate, and with the help of the people on the ground, of course, it did a fantastic job and came back safely. But then the next flight, all of a sudden, is under the gun. It said, well, yeah, we made a couple of landings, but we had an explosion. Do we really need to keep doing this? Don't we have enough rocks the way it is? So there was starting to be criticism of the program as a result of the explosion. Then there was the fact that the two chaps I had chosen to go with me had not flown before, and my buddies didn't give me a heck of a lot of credit for just 16 minutes of spaceflight, so we were dubbed the Three Rookies, Apollo 14. The Three Rookies, and that put a little bit of added interest. It gave us a little bit of additional incentive to absolutely fly the very best flight that had ever been flown before or since. And quite frankly, we came very close to that.
How old were you for this flight?
Well, actually, when I was walking around on the moon, I was 47 years old.
That's pretty old for an astronaut. That's pretty old for a flight to the moon, isn't it?
Well, I think age is a very much of an individual thing. I still feel very young at my current age, which is, you know.
Now, before you landed on the moon, you lost your radar, and Mission Control was thinking you should abort, but you didn't. Why didn't you want to abort?
You got to be kidding. I mean, after going 230,000 miles, you're going to worry about a little radar? Come on.
A little radar? I mean, what was it like for you to maneuver the ship without radar? What was blinded without radar?
Well, let me just back up a little bit. We had a problem earlier on the way out where we couldn't dock with a lunar module. That was traumatic. We finally got that resolved, and off we went with permission to land. We started down, well, we didn't actually start down, but we ran the computer down open loop, and it refused to go down because it was a bad switch. So that was point number two. Either one of those would have ruined the mission. So we were pretty objectively oriented when we came to the point where during the descent, one is not looking at the moon. You're looking away from the surface. And in order to be allowed to continue below around 13,000 feet or so, one has to have an update from landing radar. We were down around 20,000, somewhere along in there, and we were not getting updated on the radar. and we were being told from the ground that the radar wasn't working. We said, thank you very much. We understand the radar is not working. We can tell that. And they reminded us that we didn't have landing radar in by 13,000 feet. We said, yeah, we remember all that stuff. And it was getting pretty tense and pretty close. Finally, some bright young guy in the control center said, hey, this landing radar is working, but it's locked on infinity. Have them recycle, pull a circuit breaker and see what happens. So we pulled the circuit breaker, and sure enough, the landing radar came in with a matter of, maybe a half a minute or so to spare. We go on down and land, and we're shutting off the switches, and my co-pilot, Ed Mitchell, said to me, Alan, what were you going to do if the landing radar was not in at 13,000 feet? And I said, Ed, you will never know.
Well, what did you plan on doing?
I think I would have gone down, at least to the point where we could have pitched over and taken a look at the surface, because had great, great faith in our ability to land from almost any off-nominal case. We practiced that in the simulator for hours and hours and hours. And so I had a feeling that if I could just see it and realize I wasn't running into any mountains or anything, that I probably would have gone down.
What surprised you most about how the surface of the moon looked?
I don't think we had any surprises about the actual surface of the moon, about the barrenness. We had looked at pictures of our landing site taken by previous missions. We had worked with the models that were made from those pictures. We knew the general configuration of where the craters were supposed to be. We knew the objective of Cone Crater, which was the one we climbed up the side of to get rock samples. There weren't any surprises there. The surprise I had was standing on the surface after we'd been there for a few minutes, having a chance to rest a little bit and looking up at the Earth for the first time. Now, you have to look up because that's where it is, and the sky is totally black, and here you have a planet which is four times the size of the moon as we look at it from the Earth. And you also have a color. You have a blue oceans and the brown land masses, the brown continents, and you can see ice on the ice caps on the North Pole and so on. And just an absolute incredible view. And then you say, that looks a little small to me. It looks like it does have limits. It's a little fragile. You know, down here we think it's infinite. We don't worry about resources. Up there you're saying, gosh, you know, it's a shame those folks down there can't get along together and think about trying to conserve, to save what limited resources they have. And it was just very, very emotional. I actually shed a couple of tears looking up at the Earth and having those feelings.
What was the best advice that you got from astronauts who'd been to the moon before?
Hey, it ain't so tough after all, fellas. Just go up there and relax and have fun.
One of the things you did on the moon was to hit a couple of golf balls. Where did the golf club come from and the golf balls? And why'd you do it?
Well, I enjoyed the game of golf before I went, and I tried to think of something that would demonstrate the fact we only had 1/6 gravity, which means the ball is going to go 6 times as far for the same club head speed. There's no atmosphere, so the ball is not going to hook or slice. And the time of flight is going to be 6 times as long. So I started thinking about it and very quickly realized that we had a collapsible handle there, aluminum handle, we used with a scoop on the end. And we used that to scoop up samples of dust, and we put them in a little bag and mark the bag and bring it back. We use that because it's very difficult to bend over and get a sample from a virgin dust. But that would have been left up there, so I took a look at it, and it was about the same as the length of a shaft of a number 6 iron. So I got the head of a number 6 and cut it off and put a little fitting, had a pro put a little fitting on it to snap on the end of this club, and I had the club head on and the two golf balls in the pocket of my suit. I had practiced before we went. I got the boss's permission to do it. And at the very end of the mission, when all was completed, I snapped the club head on the handle, tossed the two golf balls down in the dust, kind of teed him up a little bit, and took a whack and did it in front of the television camera. So we have a great picture in the book of this ball sailing up and off into the black sky. The suit was kind of cumbersome, and I couldn't swing as hard as I wanted, so it probably would have gone maybe 30, 35 yards with one hand shot here on the earth, but it went over 200 yards. The time of flight was like 40 seconds. Just an absolute thrill for me to do that. And in the book, you actually see a picture of the golf ball still in the frame, which is kind of cute.
And one of the things that really amazes me about your life is that, okay, you're the first man in space, American in space, and then you walk on the moon. But when you were young, you went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. It seems like such an enormous gap between a one-room schoolhouse and a walk on the moon.
Well, that's true. But I sense that there is something here that was helpful to me. I remember, of course, that being in a one-room school with one teacher, there was a tremendous amount of learning, learning time there. Very, very strict teacher, as I recall. She was about 8 feet tall, and she had a long yardstick that she used to whack our knuckles with. But there was a sense of discipline instilled at that time, which I responded favorably to. And I think that sense of discipline obviously served me in good stead going through the Naval Academy, served me in good stead as a pilot, as a test pilot, as an astronaut. So maybe, maybe that one-room school thing wasn't so bad after all.
Were there airports around you when you were growing up?
There was one fairly close by. In high school, I used to work at that airport on weekends. I'd ride my bike up and push airplanes in and out of the hangars and get a free ride once in a while.
Did you love it?
Oh, yeah. I've always wanted to fly. Built model airplanes. Lindbergh was my hero when he flew across the Atlantic. And very, very fortunately, we're talking about Apollo 11. When the Apollo 11 launched, I was at the Cape, standing by myself over in a VIP observation section, a figure in a pair of fatigues and an old sailor hat turned upside down came over and reintroduced himself as Colonel Charles Lindbergh. I had met him before, but only briefly. But that moment, the two of us stood there, and nobody bothered us. We were there for 15 or 20 minutes without interruption, and I was telling him at that time, as my hero, how much he had meant to me, and how much he encouraged me indirectly to become involved in aviation. And he said very, very graciously, well, obviously, Captain, at that time, he said, you're doing the same thing for the people who are going to fly in space tomorrow to the planets and beyond. And it was a very poignant moment, one which I will never forget.
Well, Alan Shepard, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Alan Shepard is the co-author of the new book, Moonshot, the inside story of America's race to the moon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Gravity! The big G!
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a new girl meets girl romantic comedy. It won't be confined to the gay film festival circuit. It has a major distributor and will soon open theatrically in many cities around the country. We talk with filmmakers Rose Trochet and Guinevere Turner about why they didn't want to make a movie about coming out. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Colored People, the new memoir by Henry Louis Gates, chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal judge has lifted the ban on logging in parts of the Northwest. The ban was intended to preserve the habitat of the spotted owl. U.S. District Judge William Dwyer issued an order allowing the government to resume timber sales, but he didn't rule on the legality of the Clinton administration's plan to resume logging at a much slower pace than in the 1980s. Dwyer has set a schedule for a new round of written and oral arguments over the plan. President Clinton has joined several heads of state from allied nations today in Normandy for D-Day memorial ceremonies. It's the 50th anniversary of the Allied invasion of France, which led to the downfall of Adolf Hitler and the German Third Reich. Mr. Clinton thanked the veterans for their heroism and sacrifice. He reminded the world that without the strength of the Allied soldiers, the world would have lost democracy.
Today, many of them are here among us. Oh, they may walk with a little less spring in their step, and their ranks are growing thinner. But let us never forget, when they were young, these men saved the world.
The president laid wreaths and monuments to slain U.S. soldiers at Utah Beach. About 100,000 people are attending the ceremonies. Chinese authorities say all 160 people aboard a China jetliner died today when it crashed shortly after takeoff. The BBC's James Miles reports from Beijing.
Chinese officials said the crashed airliner was a Russian-built Tupolev 154, which fell to the ground about 8 minutes after takeoff from the city of Xi'an on its way to the southern city of Canton. Officials said there were 14 crew members and 146 passengers on board. They said 10 of the passengers were foreigners, including one person from Hong Kong. The nationality of the other foreigners hasn't been announced. One Chinese passenger survived the crash, but died later of his injuries in hospital. There are no indications yet what caused the disaster. One official said, however, that the plane broke up in midair. State-run television showed pictures of widely scattered wreckage, with parts of the plane lying in a stream and surrounding paddy fields.
James Miles reporting. Taiwanese authorities say a hijacker who took over a Chinese airliner and ordered it to Taipei has given himself up. The China Southern Airlines jet was on a domestic flight when it was commandeered. There were no casualties. Sara Lee Corporation says it's going to lay off between 8 and 9,000 workers. That's 6% of its workforce. Sara Lee says it needs to become more efficient. The firm will also close, consolidate, and realign some of its facilities. And Sara Lee plans to take a fourth quarter charge of $495 million to pay for all this. Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials fell 4 points to end at 3,768. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The Mormon Church has chosen Howard Hunter as its new leader. Hunter becomes the 14th prophet, seer, and revelator of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The 86-year-old Hunter succeeds Ezra Taft Benson, who died last week. Hunter has two assistants who will help him run the church's first presidency, Gordon Hinckley and Thomas Monson. Hinckley, who's 83, is next in line to succeed Hunter in the lifetime appointment. Presidents of the 164-year-old faith are revered as divinely appointed to receive revelations from God. Negotiations to bring about a ceasefire in Bosnia have resumed in Geneva. The Bosnian government has given the green light to the talks after it was satisfied all Serbian troops had withdrawn from the UN exclusion zone around Garajda. NPR's Tom Jolton reports.
Sarajevo media today declared the news from Garajda to represent a diplomatic victory for the Bosnian government. President Alija Izetbegović had refused to authorize his delegation to begin ceasefire talks until Serb soldiers had entirely withdrawn from the exclusion zone around Garajda as called for under a UN agreement and a NATO ultimatum. Yesterday, UN troops in the area escorted the last remaining Serb soldiers out of the exclusion zone, and today local Bosnian army commanders patrolling the area with the UN forces agreed that no more armed Serbs were in the zone. As soon as President Izetbegović got the news, he ordered his delegation in Geneva to begin negotiations. An initial session was scheduled between the Bosnian delegation and UN envoy Yasushi Yakashi. I'm Tom Jelton in Sarajevo.
Workers in the Russian nuclear power industry say they're going to have to cut back power and even close down plants because there's no money. They're also threatening to cut back on maintenance. The chairman of the nuclear power industry's labor union held a news conference today to warn of their desperate plight. They say Moscow must pump an enormous amount of money into the nuclear power industry right away. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the hits of this year's Sundance Film Festival was a girl-meets-girl romantic comedy called Go Fish. The New Yorker magazine says it's not a coming-out movie, it's a we're-so-out-we-have-all-the-problems-everybody-else-has movie. Vogue describes it as charming, offbeat, thoughtful, and visually inventive. The Sundance Film Festival success helped land a major distributor, Samuel Goldwyn. This week, Go Fish opens in New York. In July, it opens in the top 20 markets. My guests are director Rose Trochet and star Guinevere Turner. They also co-wrote and co-produced the film. Turner plays Max, a single woman in her 20s looking for a girlfriend. Her roommate, a women's studies teacher named Kia, arranges a meeting between Max and a woman named Eli. Max and Eli go to a movie, but Max doesn't think they're right for each other. Eli doesn't have the right look. She's too retro. But this sounds like a pretty shallow excuse to Max's roommate.
Okay, maybe I thought after you got past your shallow fashion requirements, you might find Eli interesting.
Kia, interesting? Okay, let me go over the things about her that were really working for me. Dresses like my mama in the 70s, had 100 different kinds of tea, all decaf, she liked that stupid movie, she doesn't seem to be interested in her own oppression, and last and most important, she's married.
Really? To who? To Kate?
You mean you knew she had a girlfriend?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I thought they broke up. They don't even live in the same city.
Try 2 years of not living in the same city. And in all that time, they visited each other 3 times.
Crazy. I remember when Kate was in my class.
She was? When?
A couple of years before you.
What does she look like? Probably a total hippie, right?
I'm not even going to start in on this one. Just tell me. Regular, crunchy, or extra crunchy? Max, settle down. I won't say if she's a hippie or not, but keep in mind, she did move to Seattle.
Extra crunchy. It doesn't matter anyway. I remain as I have been for quite some time. A carefree single lesbo.
Looking for love.
It strikes me from this movie that you weren't interested in making the am I gay film or the anguish of coming out type film or, you know, the film about how difficult it is to be gay in American culture.
It's absolutely a film that almost reacts to that. And I wouldn't say that it's the opposite of that. It's just another part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are out already, all of them, you know. And that was definitely one of the things we set out to do in making Go Fish is not to have another coming out film. I mean, there's just, yeah, there's so many men
in fact,
and women's films, actually.
There are very few lesbian films that don't in some way revolve around some sort of crisis about naming your sexuality or claiming your sexuality.
So you wanted to do a film where that's just taken for granted?
Yes.
Absolutely. Much like the way it is in our lives, which is we don't wake up every morning thinking, oh my God, I'm a lesbian today again, you know?
Yeah, sometimes it's almost more powerful to just go about your daily life and be exactly that and not have it be a spectacle at all. And that's what Go Fish is kind of trying to do cinematically.
Now, the relationship in the movie centers around two women. One of them's in her 20s. This is Max, Guinevere, the role that you play.
Mm-hmm.
And the other woman is closer, I'd say, probably to her late 30s or early 40s. She came of age more in the 70s. And they have different styles in the way they dress and what their values are. So did you want to, as one of the issues in the movie, kind of contrast women who came of age in the 70s with those who are coming of age now? Came of age in the 80s?
That's so funny that you say
so
that.
I was just going to say that's so funny.
I mean, Eli is supposed to be older than Max, but only by about, you know, 5 years or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just assume because of certain signifiers.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we were trying to make her into the sort of the lesbian of today who is, you know, that health nut, that, who is that sort of hippie-ish person, but not that she was actually from that time, just that she was sort of mimicking that aesthetic.
That aesthetic, yeah. And I think it's funny because the joke is brought up, the whole 70s thing is brought up because it's just like Max to think that you know, Eli's aesthetic is very 70s because she would have never, like, kind of ascribed to it to that same aesthetic herself. And but it's truly not. It's just that she's, you know, kind of crunchy dyke, you know.
As in crunchy granola.
Yeah, right, as in crunchy, exactly. as in what do we hear in Seattle? As in kumbaya.
That's what they call them in Seattle, the kumbayas.
You're both in your 20s, right?
I have recently left my 20s 2 days ago.
Congratulations on your birthday.
I just turned
30. Yeah. I'm 26.
So when you were coming out, were there things that you didn't relate to in the style or in some of the values of lesbians who were older than you?
Absolutely. That whole, like, lavender sister thing, I just could not relate to. Like, women's music, I mean, and believe me, I've gone to the Michigan Women's Music Festival for 5 years in a row, you know, kind of a streak that ended about 3 years ago. And I remember going to Mountain Movie Coffee House, you know, which was like a drug-free, separatist space. And in a lot of ways, I couldn't relate to that, you know.
What couldn't you relate to about
I couldn't
that?
Relate to actually how insular it was and how much it fed its own self. It was just such a weird, you know what it struck me as? It almost struck me as being religious. And that was always, it was weird. I mean, I grew up religious, but that's a feeling it always gave me, like, underneath. And that was, I've kind of shifted my lifestyle in such a way that I'm more comfortable with it now. Not being a lesbian, but the acting out of that, or who I hang around with in a social situation. There are, I mean, it's like, I guess... I'm getting myself in a hole here, because I think the hole that I'm getting myself in is that I've shifted from the humorless lesbian to the lesbian with humor, and you know, it's not quite that cut and dry.
Well, I think it's really also has a lot to do with the fact that, okay, so you decide you're a lesbian. Well, and where you go first, mm-hmm. And the fact is, I mean, if you want to go look in the paper and find, you're going to end up in places like, you know, chem-free spaces where everyone has hairy legs and it's all very like. Has this sort of communal sort of sisterhood feeling that while I respect it, I so don't relate to it. I mean, I smoke, I drink, mm-hmm. I like to, you know, make mean jokes and pick mm-hmm. on people and, you know what I mean? Just be myself, you know, not be all encompassing and beautiful and sweet just because I'm a lesbian.
Right.
And so, but essentially what you end up doing is sort of finding your own way and making your own sort of group of friends.
But it definitely has to do with, unfortunately, because it sounds so shallow, it has to do with like looks politics, you know? I think that there was finally a movement to say we don't have to embrace everybody. We don't have to be like wonderful, nice, like because in a way it like took all these things that were woman, which in some ways are a stereotype. I mean, we're all kind of socialized to be like good and
nurturing.
You know, passive and yeah, nurturing. And it's just like I personally don't have an interest
in nurturing anyone.
Yeah.
Your film has been shown at the Sundance Film Festival and at a recent lesbian gay film festival in New York. Did you get different reactions from those two festivals?
Oh, my God, yeah.
You wouldn't believe what it's like to see the movie with a room full of lesbians.
What's it like?
It's ecstatic. I mean, it's like you can just feel that the sort of relief of the room. Like, everyone is sitting there going, I can't believe it. Like, I can't believe this is finally on the screen. It's such a great feeling.
It's amazing.
I mean, not that people didn't like it in Sundance, but when you're sitting there with the target audience, it's like, oh, yeah, this is why we did this.
Yeah. It was really, like, the energy was completely different. And we were, it's funny because it kind of parallels life a lot of times in a straight world. It's like if you're queer in a straight world, which we all of us who are queer in a straight world, it's enough and you should be grateful just for tolerance and just for acceptance. And so, I think that's kind of a phenomenon that happened at Sundance. I mean, we didn't know what to expect. We didn't know if people would hate it, and if they hated it, we kind of knew why. You know, because it's a lesbian film. It speaks to a lesbian audience. And when they didn't, it was so surprising. to be accepted. And I think we were really grateful on that level. But man, to be with a queer audience is just like where those kind of like those issues don't come up. It's a whole different, it's just a whole different thing.
My guests are Rose Trochet and Guinevere Turner, the director and star of the new movie Go Fish. They also co-wrote the film. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rose Trochet and Guinevere Turner, their new movie is called Go Fish. You made your film on very little money, on a very small budget, and you weren't in the kinds of film circles where you already had access to a bunch of actors that you could use. So how did you go about casting your movie, knowing that you probably wouldn't be able to pay anybody very much, at least up front?
Well, we definitely knew we wouldn't be able to pay anyone. And we were in a circle of people, of other filmmakers, where we could get equipment, so that covered that cost kind of. But in terms of actresses, wow, what do? We asked them.
Were they already actors?
No, not at all. I think their motivation primarily came from the same place our motivation was that they wanted to see this kind of lesbian movie being done.
So they didn't have experience?
No, they didn't have experience. Not at all.
None of us did.
Did you set yourself any ground rules? Like, for example, all the actresses had to be lesbians?
We never talked about it.
Yeah, I don't think we ever actually talked about that.
But I think it's because it never came up.
Because we didn't think anyone who wasn't a lesbian would believe in something enough to commit to something.
And would want to be
thoroughly.
In it.
Because we gave them each a speech before we first put them on camera, which was, okay, you realize once you're on camera, you have to stick with the project till the end because otherwise you're useless. You know what I mean? Otherwise all the footage you're in is useless and we just can't have that. We're not that kind of operation. And they were all like, okay. And they all did. I don't think that too many heterosexual people would commit to that, you know, for free.
I don't know. Maybe if they, you know, in no way, you have to remember, in no way did we know that the film would do this well. And we don't know theatrically if it's done well or not because it hasn't been released yet. But we certainly, this is something we did not count on. This was really, it was a labor of love for everybody. I mean, we thought it would show gay and lesbian film festivals and that would be about it.
I saw one article that said, well, one of the reasons why the film is getting released to theaters now has to do with lesbian chic. Is there such a thing as lesbian chic happening now? And if so, what is it?
I think it's two words that's printed in a magazine every so often. I mean, I just don't think that there are... I'll tell you what, it makes me a little bit angry, and it makes me angry in lieu of everything. I mean, 3 years ago when we started making Go Fish, there was no lesbian chic. Katie Lang wasn't out. Melissa Etheridge wasn't out. You know, and it's just, it's a weird movement because it's kind of a media, it's not a movement at all, it's kind of a media labeling that completely denies what we go through on a daily basis when we're out as lesbians, you know, like fear of being bashed, not being able to walk down the streets with our lovers, you know, and be affectionate. I mean, it completely denies a reality and makes it into like something that's supposed to be fashionable. I mean, it's like it's a little bit of a ridiculous thing.
Go Fish focuses on one couple. And I'm wondering if you were ever a couple while making the movie.
Have you read that somewhere? She's like, it's such a setup question.
Yeah. Isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, we were. We broke up in the middle of production.
And we won't talk anymore about it.
So did the couple in the movie didn't draw on your relationship at all, did it?
Oh no. That would be a scary movie.
Oh, that would be just so horrifying. That would be like Go Fish meets Naked.
Have you seen Naked?
Oh, I have seen Naked, yeah.
So it would be. That's what it would be. That's what I predict the movie about.
Meets Jurassic Park.
Meets Jurassic Park. That would be me in the morning.
You're not painting a very nice picture of your relationship.
Oh, it just really... I mean, some people have nice little even ones, and some people have tumultuous relationships, and we just have always...
Had a tumultuous relationship.
And it's fine. It's like, you know, we were still young enough to handle it. But now that I've turned 30... I'll have to go.
Well, what was it like having a tumultuous relationship that had ended and to continue making the movie together?
Very difficult.
I mean, one of the houses that we shot in was a set. So, you know, for example, when I moved out, I couldn't even take my furniture because it was part of the movie set. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the kind of difficult we're talking. You can't even separate. And we couldn't separate our finances because we're both producers on this project. We're so entangled. Everything was just entangled. I mean, it was extraordinarily difficult. And then to have to direct someone, you know, and also have to work on re-editing, writing together. And, you know, I mean, it puts a little kink in the plan there. You know.
But it sounds like you're still on decent terms.
This is only for radio.
Yeah. We'll fight as soon as we're off the air.
We get put in cells as soon as we walk out the door.
With muzzles. Yeah. No, we do pretty well. I mean, we've been known to quarrel in front of interviewers, but for the most part, we have a sense of humor about each other now because, you know, we don't see each other except when we're doing stuff like this.
No, I think, Rose, this is the first film you directed, and Guinevere, this is the first film you've acted in, and you co-wrote the film together, co-produced mm-hmm. it together. What direction do you each want to head in now?
Oh, Rose.
All my good news. My good news for the day. I'm making a second feature, and it's kind of surrounding queer Hollywood in the 40s. So I'm really looking forward to that.
And the good news is that she just got funding to write the script.
That's good. Yeah. And Guinevere, what about you?
I'm going all over the place in 5 million different directions. I for the moment, I guess I'm pursuing acting mostly just because, although it's not at all what I thought would come of this project, that's what people are encouraging me to do, and that's what agents are wanting to sell me on. I'm also writing a book, and I'm also thinking about possibly writing another script.
Well, thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Okay, no thank problem. You.
Thank you.
Rose Trochet and Guinevere Turner, their new movie, Go Fish, opens in New York this weekend and opens in the top 20 markets in July. This is Fresh Air. Today is the 50th anniversary of D-Day. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on D-Day on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing reports today from Normandy and from some of the anniversary observances there, including a reenactment of the landing on the beaches that'll be taking place. In addition, Nina Ellis has a special report today about the town of Bedford, Virginia, which suffered incredibly large losses, although it's a very small town, in the invasion of Normandy 50 years ago, how the memory of the invasion was at one time lost and now restored to that town is the subject of her report.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates is known to a wide audience for his path-breaking studies of African-American literature and for his articles on controversial subjects like rap music lyrics and black anti-Semitism in papers like the New York Times and the Village Voice. Gates has a new memoir called Colored People, in which he tells the story of his coming of age in the 50s and early 60s in West Virginia. Critic Maureen Carrigan has this review.
As critic Adam Begley pointed out in a recent issue of the irreverent academic journal Lingua Franca, it's become a hot trend for scholars to publish their memoirs for a popular audience. This frightening phenomenon was set in motion by feminist critics in the 1970s, who decided not to write anymore in the traditional third-person voice of God, but rather in the first person. This subjective style has influenced other academics who are now going one step further and analyzing their own lives as texts. Knowing how academic egos can run amok, I'm wary of this trend. But the recent memoirs I've read have been pretty absorbing. There's been French professor Alice Kaplan's award-winning book, French Lessons, and tough guy English professor Frank Lentricchia's memoir, The Edge of Night. Now, Henry Louis Gates has weighed in with colored people. Gates introduces colored people with a letter to his two daughters. He says his reason for writing about his life is to teach them and us about the vanished world of Piedmont, West Virginia. Piedmont was the mill town where he lived with his mother, who worked as a cleaning woman, his father, a mill worker, and his older brother. Gates claims he is not trying to be, quote, every Negro. Instead, this is a small story about his childhood and adolescence and the sort of segregated peace that once prevailed in Piedmont. Taken on these terms, colored people is vivid, sentimental, and even moving, kind of like the Waltons told from another side of the mountain. Some of Gates's most charming recollections have to do with the dances, hairstyles, and TV shows he and his friends liked. In Piedmont, Gates says, the TV was the ritual arena for the drama of race. Everyone gathered at night to watch what Dr. King was doing. Years later, Gates grew the town's first Afro. His father, he remembers, disparagingly called it KKK hair. Naughty, kinky, and can't comey. But there's also something irritating about colored people. It has to do with the suspicious seamlessness of the world Gates recreates. We know he left Piedmont for Yale, but we don't meet the young Gates who wanted to make that journey. We know he dated white girls, but we don't know how Gates understands these interracial attractions. The uneasy sense that Gates is keeping a lot of himself to himself is compounded by his voice. He speaks almost exclusively in the language of the Piedmont kid he was and doesn't give us the benefit of his adult voice. For instance, he writes, "You could be as ugly as homemade sin dipped in misery and still be thought attractive if you had good hair." As evocative as that one sentence is, a whole book of it sounds corny. Gates's performance here feels forced. It reminds me of an academic conference I heard about where two scholars gave papers. The first scholar, an African-American academic, presented his paper as a rap song. The second, a Marxist, talked purely in the language of his old blue-collar neighborhood. Speech that was once authentic came off as phony because it had to be consciously put on. Now, I don't think that Gates or anybody should sound like Alastair Cook or even Russell Baker. But like it or not, studying literature does change how you present yourself in words. The Gates who's doing the remembering in colored people keeps too silent, and the Gates who's being remembered sounds too rustic and rusty.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Colored People by Henry Louis Gates. Fresh Air returned today to Northwest Public Radio. It's good to be back. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Cancer patients can choose between a number of options in conventional and alternative therapies, but the information about these options is usually ambiguous, complex, and confusing. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Lerner shares some of his research into integrating conventional and alternative therapies. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.